After hearing Max talk, I adjusted my talk slightly during lunch in order to make it more useful to you, and so you didn't have to listen to some of the same material twice. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is how to actually implement a third-party risk management program, and also how to get lots and lots of money for your program to do not just that, but anything you need to do. So that's sort of my specialty. That's where I come from, so we're going to talk a bit about that. So a little bit about my background. I've been in IT for almost 25 years, a little over 15 of that, actually going on 20 now, has been in cyber. And most of that has been on the information security side of the house, and then I did some time in IT risk management as well, just to see how that side was working also. But I started out as a hardcore developer, working for startups in the dot-com era, and so I fell in love with innovation. And actually, that's why I got into cyber, because I could tell it was so innovative, and I think it gets a really bad rap as something that slows down progress and is something that gets in the way of things like innovation, but in fact, that's really just a symptom of you bolting it on and not building it in. I think it's actually an incredibly cool space. So, I worked, most of my time has been in the finance industry, where healthcare is right now. We're experiencing in the healthcare space a lot of what finance was experiencing about 15, 20 years ago. So let's learn from that experience and try not, you know, learn from the good things that were happening there, the best practices, and try to learn from the mistakes as well. So I try to address that in this talk also. And maintaining the edge, I'm sort of obsessed with staying on the cutting edge of the latest risks we're seeing, the latest threats. Cyber is one of those areas where you can't sort of take a step back and just say, okay, well, I get the bigger concepts. I'm sure this is just the new flavor of the month type thing. You actually have to really be super engaged if you're gonna be a good practitioner at what you do. In case you're wondering why I chose to talk about third-party management, I will tell you that I ran third-party management in the aughts for a small company you may have heard of called Citi Group. So we had over 100,000 vendors. So when I talk to you about this, I assure you I've got scale backing this plan. So let's dive a little bit into this. So a little level setting here. I know some of you are experts in your field. I know some of you are maybe new to this area. So what I'm trying to do is, if you're a novice, you're going to get quite a bit out of this. I want your vocabulary to be one where you can sort of speak about this whenever you need to, either as a stakeholder or responding to initiative. And if you're an expert, what I'm hoping is you can just take my plan, use it, and then move on to another problem you have, which I'm sure we all have many, many, many problems on our plate. So that's what I'm hoping you'll get out of this. So what we saw is that in the healthcare space in particular, we saw the incidents went up 60% last year. And again, these aren't breaches, these are incidents. And then 19% of U.S. healthcare companies reported being breached. And again, this is all coming from the Verizon report and other various sources. If you need the sources, I'm happy to get them to you. And this is actually a very conservative number. That healthcare data is worth 10 times as much on the black market. It's actually more like 100 and 500 times financials. Your identity is worth 10 cents. Nobody cares about that. One of the reasons for that is that if your credit card is stolen, you get a new one the next day in the mail. I can't give you a new medical history. Medical histories are being used to blackmail people. How would you like your entire medical history put tomorrow on the internet, readable to everyone? Maybe you wouldn't be into that. If you're a betting person, you might want to know the medical record of a particular athlete who may or may not have undergone surgery. But for the most part, this data is being stolen and then sort of ransomed back to the company they stole it from for a premium. It's also being leveraged for free medical services and also drugs. So, you know, if you're an elderly person and you're on Medicare, Medicaid, those are the credentials that are worth, without question, the most. So we're all in healthcare. We all have access to data. People want what we got, so we got to do the best job we can to protect the patients and keep it safe. And an average security breach, I think this is last year's number, this is $3 to $4 million. I think we're going to see this go up quite a bit, especially with some of these more unusual breaches we're seeing that have a little bit more of a personal impact. You know, for example, Aetna's HIV breach that they just experienced, I think it's going to go well beyond just the typical monitoring your credit score and your history. I think it's going to get a little more personal. I think we're going to see these numbers kind of go up, not down. And this just, the OCR just came out with this report. 85% of hospitals don't have it. And I put security expert in quotes because they basically said no one. They don't even, not even a firewall expert. You know, not even. I'm not talking a CISO. I'm not talking a director of information security. I'm talking anybody who has any concept of security whatsoever. This report just came out. 85% of hospitals don't have someone matching that description. And this is terrifying. I mean, this is really bad news, especially since, and I didn't want to put this in print, but apparently the top 10, I was just at Black Hat DEF CON, and there was a bunch of Sky Talks, which are talks that happen off the record with healthcare experts. And one of the things that came out of that was that the average medical device has 14,000 vulnerabilities on it that are remotely executable. And we got to do better. We got to do better than that as an industry. So it's a little bit of the state of the industry right now. So all these companies have been breached, are in the headlines as being breached, but they really weren't breached. Well, some of them were, but most of them were not. Their third party was breached. And you know, with the, I call it game of headlines, kind of like Game of Thrones. It's just the people want people to read the news. And if you put in, if I gave you the slide that had the name of the third party that was actually hacked, you wouldn't know who they were. They're small companies here, there, everywhere. That's not fun for the media. The media doesn't have a blast doing that kind of stuff. They pick the biggest name in the chain, and slam that on the headline. So I'm going to give you a 5-step plan. Seriously, just 5 steps to help you build your third-party management program and get it off the ground. So first, you want to establish the committee. Second, you want to confirm your third-party inventory. Third, you want to classify your third parties based on financial risk and security risk, and we're going to talk about how to do that. Then you want to perform the appropriate assessment type, and then you want to create an ongoing process for onboarding, monitoring, and offboarding these third parties. So first things first, you got to form a committee. You got to include, of course, legal from a contractual point of view, information security, of course, to help you run the assessments. Risk and compliance is, I have it sort of at the top, they tend to run this organization. It's not that they are in charge of all the stakeholders, they're just usually the most interested party that's got the vocabulary to talk about the inputs and the outputs of it. Finance and procurement, of course, big piece of this, and we'll talk about how they fit in. And the business stakeholders, you need to make sure that the actual owners of the third party relationships are engaged. So inventory, oh, I love this. Everyone always likes to say vendor risk management, which makes me crazy. It's third parties. I assure you, your clients, just like your vendors, can bring you down. So anyone who's connected to your network in some way, shape, or form can hurt you. Now, you may not be able to be in a position to go to your clients and say, hey, I want you to do the following 6 things so I feel more safe. They're probably going to tell you, you know, go away. So you have more oversight over your vendors, you're in a better position to tell them what you want to happen or not. But it's really critical that when you're creating the inventory, you don't limit it to your vendors. You have to talk about also your clients and your affiliates. Let me tell you a great story. So I was working at Citi, and one of my buddies who's an ethical hacker called me, and he was laughing. And he said, hey, you still do pen testing and vulnerability assessments at Citi? And I said, oh, no, it's a different team now. Why? And he goes, oh, man, the Citi bike app, it's a mess. And I said, oh, really? And I said, well, let me talk to the person in charge of that program, and let me see what I can find out for you. So I started calling around. I called the CISO. I call everyone at Citi, and I'm trying to get the answers for what's happening around the Citi bike app, which is apparently vulnerable as all get out. And it's about to go live in a week, and I'm just going, what's going on here? Turns out that app had been designed by the Department of Transportation, and Truly, who they had outsourced it to, had literally turned off the security features that were built into the code that was being used to be designed and released. But whose name was all over it? city's name was all over it. The Department of Transportation's name was not on it. You know, city's name was on it. And so there needs to be this sort of understanding that even though, you know, the Department of Transportation in no way reported into city, that there was that relationship.
What is an ethical hacker?
We're going to talk about ethical hackers. I assure you, we're going to get into ethical hackers. Those are good guys that have to be bad guys to help keep you safe. And we're going to talk about what those are: pen testers, red team, vulnerability assessment people. We're going to talk about what those, exactly what they do, and how to leverage the findings from them. So yes. So when you're building this inventory, a lot of companies have not ever thought about third-party management until now. It's been something that's been sort of forced into something we now have to think about. Usually it was, oh, who do we give money to? That was how this was all approached for so long. So when you go to build this inventory, you got to get it from a variety of different locations, because again, the chances of you having this comprehensive list are small, and you shouldn't be embarrassed about that. That is no big deal. You can get it. I assure you, we can get the list. There's four great places to get it from. First and foremost, finance. Who did we actually pay? Talk to them, get the list. I assure you they have a list of who's been paid and not paid in the last year. That's a great place to start. They can also at that time tell you the size of the payment, and we get into how later that helps with the risk classification of the vendor. From a legal point of view, if there's a contract in place, again, great source of inventory material here. If we've signed a contract with someone, chances are we at least at one time did business with them. IT, great source of this information. Who connects to us and gets our data? Who do we send data to and receive data from? Absolutely, the IT team knows all kinds of things you wouldn't possibly imagine. And something else that's wonderful about this is when I built the program at Citi, I made it so you couldn't open up firewall rules with a company and a vendor or a client until you went through my program. Because if you came through my program, because what was happening was the business was going straight to the firewall teams and sitting on them saying, open this, because I want this connectivity. And they were going, ooh, we don't really know if this is a secure connection. We don't really know if we have all the correct contracts in place. That wasn't the right conversation. Those weren't the two people that should have been communicating. So my process got inserted in the middle. And that way I made sure that no connectivity ever occurred with these companies until it had gone through the appropriate control. So IT can also be a great source of control here for setting up your third parties. And the business, of course, the business knows who they rely on. So they're a great group. If you can send them a list and say, hey, this is what we think applies to you, or are we missing anybody? They can also tell you, of course, what do these people do for us, which is a huge piece of this. So whenever I do talks, I'm really focused on, if you have a lot of money, I'm going to tell you how to do this in a way that's super convenient and easy to implement. And if you have no money, I'm going to tell you how to do that as well. Because I've worked in this industry long enough to see two pretty serious recessions where getting money for your cybersecurity budget is just not a priority. It's very hard to show that the money you spent stopped something bad from happening, at least in the early days. Now we've got way better ways of doing that. But for a long time, you just had to be super convincing. So if you're on a DIY, a do-it-yourself type budget, you can manage this in a spreadsheet or on a SharePoint site. You can have if you have a close relationship with your development team, you can have them build a quick UI with the database behind it. If you've money, there's of course companies that are more than willing to come on site and help you dredge up the inventory list. You can get a GRC tool, governance, risk, and compliance tool that helps you manage a lot of what you do in terms of audit and compliance. And one of the things they have now is third-party modules that'll help you manage this. This is probably one of the more dense slides I'm going to show you. I try not to show too many slides with a lot of words. This is to classify your third parties. This is how, and I designed this specifically for healthcare. So when you're going through the list of the third parties and you're trying to decide how much oversight is involved, you can go through this list. Are they critical? Do they have access to restricted data? Are they high? Do they have access to private data, medium, public, or low? Do they have access to no data? And they do not support a critical function. Focusing on offshore here, since a lot of clients care about that. Focusing on the type of data, of course, a lot of clients care about that as well. You got to protect your employees also. If you've got PII, you got to make sure that's sort of folded into the mix also. And that last column is the assessment frequency. Are you doing an on-site assessment? Are you sending them a form? Are you just monitoring them using a tool like BitCider or Risk Scorecard, or checking out their certifications and leaving it at that? This is an area where you absolutely have to take a risk-based approach, or you'll blow through all your money and your staff's time doing stuff that does not matter. So you really want to go after the really heavy-hitting, PHI-focused, more dangerous vendors or vendors that really support a critical function as a top priority, and then sort of tear it down from there. If you try to do everything at one time, it's not going to work out. You might be surprised how many vendors you have. If you have that list already, fantastic. If you don't, you're going to be shocked by the size. And I will make sure these slides are made available if you're having trouble reading this or you're curious about this later. So again, you can do on-site. So let's start with on-site assessments. This on-site assessment should be focused on clients, again, offshore clients that see tons and tons of PHI, or who support a critical business critical application, something that maybe you run a lot of money through or is really important to your clients. If it goes down, you've got issues. You can do it yourself, you don't have to be a huge subject matter expert. What I find is most effective, and I put it in here, is you send about two or three people, if you can, and you give it the smallest amount of notice possible to go on site without being rude. I try to do 48 hours if possible. Sometimes I'll allow up to a week. I try not to go beyond that because you don't want the dog and pony show. You don't want that. Something else I do immediately is I dispense with the team that's been sent out to talk to me. And I say, thank you very much for greeting me. I really appreciate that. I want to talk to a database administrator, that person. And you make them talk to you. In that way, you get a less pre-canned sort of packaged answer to whatever questions you might have. I have them run reports on the fly. Okay, show me a list of every person who's entitled in your system. Show me how they've been decommed. And again, you don't have to be a risk assessment expert. Just being able to ask some sanity questions and get some reports run on the fly, you tend to get the truth very quickly, and you can sort of feel in your bones if the company you're working with is really on the up and up and doing what you require. Just make sure they're aligned with industry standards. I'm not even going to touch the industry standards topic after this morning, but just make sure it's one that you feel comfortable with. And of course, track the findings. And this is an area where people have a way of getting super judgmental, and there's no reason to. If you have a vendor that you work with a lot, and they are really important to you, and they have zero concept of security and risk, it doesn't mean you got to cut them off tomorrow. It means you got to work with them and get them where you want them to be. Work with them to come up with that remediation plan. Help them understand, I need you to have next-gen endpoint protection, don't spend money on antivirus, or whatever. It's a kind of silly example, but just like kind of, you help them tier it out. It's something where we can all work together to get a better solution. You don't have to go wild with this one. And of course, money. There's plenty of companies that would be delighted to sell you their services to go on site to all these companies and do this for you. And of course, they tend to have something that they're really into, whether it be AUP or shared assessments or high trust or whatever their thing is. That will be what they align to, and just make sure it makes sense for you as well. You don't want something else you have to manage to. And then, of course, tracking the findings. Yes.
I'm sorry. I don't want to interrupt you, but before you move on from this slide, I'm just curious because I know that on-site assessments, everyone does those. Does anyone have a templated approach? You outsource yours? Does anyone else conduct their own on-site assessments and has? Does everybody outsource it? Everyone outsources it?
I think we're too close to it if we do it internally ourselves. So I do it. I hire a company in Canada, the Ethical Hacker. I always say paid hacker, but I'll start using that. I like that. He comes in on-premise, does an internal, and then another team does external several months later. I kind of coordinate it with it. I don't tell my team about it at all. I want to see their reaction. to it. And that kind of leads me, because we use multi-plan. So what if I was to set up an external assessment like that? I pay my ethical hacker to hack you guys without letting you know, because I don't want you guys on alert.
Okay, so this is a risk assessment, not an ethical hack. Okay, so this is a risk assessment. There's a difference,
no,
very important difference.
No, I totally agree. But what would happen? I'm sitting here listening
to
this.
I would go berserk and... It would. I think it's maybe not even legal for you to do that.
That's what I was wondering. But shouldn't we do that?
No. No, because it takes down.
Says no.
No. It's,
why not? You know, why not? I want to know that a hacker can't get, because you've got my PHI. You are a third
party.
So
if you want to do that, it's a conversation that can absolutely happen, and it can happen. I have, for example, an internal cyber risk assessment I get done annually, where I hire red teams, pen testers, all that kind of stuff to do that to multi-plan. But if you want to do that as part of your risk assessment, that's a conversation. It's got to be off hours. You've got to decide if it's production or non-production systems. If you did that without giving someone a heads up, it's illegal and it would not go well.
I get it.
Because
I have not
ethical
done
hacking
that.
Breaks things. Like you can cause port exhaustion. And these aren't things that you're failing from a security point of view. These are things that are... It's denial of service attacks. You're causing you are hacking, so you are actually causing things to break, and that doesn't mean that you're not secure. You could just be breaking it by causing a tremendous amount of pressure.
Yeah.
So it's
But isn't that important for me to know with you containing my data?
No, because it's
my
not
PHI?
Testing the security, or it's not testing the actual security itself. It's testing your ability to respond to tremendous amounts of, IP hits. And
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, but again, I mean, I like your style. I like your style. But it is not something that would go well.
Gotcha.
Just point of clarification, if you're talking about doing this to your internal company, that's a discussion you have with your senior execs and get approval. But you're absolutely right. If you perform that function without warning your vendor, you will get a lawsuit, unless that's a function you agree to in contract.
And that's what I'm thinking, exactly.
And then you still have to have that discussion of the when's and the how's with the right people.
Right.
But ultimately, it's an agreement in contract of what's acceptable and what's not.
Yeah.
And these are awesome examples, but there are certain vendors that you will work with that will tell you, no, you can't come do an on-site assessment. That's not going to happen. Here's our, SAE 16 or whatever. But then we have to make a decision as
are we going to keep the vendor or not? Right?
Is that an acceptable clause in the contract?
Exactly what I go through. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. It's all conversation. And we call that rules of engagement if you want to do the assessment.
I think Kristen was asking about a template which people use when they do on-site visit on their vendors. If anybody has it, I would be interested in getting that also.
There's plenty that are shareable. There's no issue. I can get you a variety of choices. You just got to make sure it makes sense to your business and what's actually important to you. Yes.
So we're going to reach out to you?
Yeah, you're certain. Yes, I will make sure my team's email address is on the last slide, and we can get you that. But you'll want to tailor it to your needs. There might be areas you just don't care about and others that are more important. I don't have any PCI. I don't care about that. You might, and you might care. So it's you got to tailor it a bit. But sure, absolutely.
I'm just trying to kind of follow up with kind of the clarification we just mentioned. There are partners, third-party partners, they don't want you to come on-site. There's no articles in the contract saying you can come on-site. So I'm wondering, kind of curious how successful you have been doing those on-site visits. Do you only go to the partner, the third parties, like you have that agreement in your contract, or you have done those on-site visits for those you don't have that agreement?
It's a great question. You've got two choices in that case. So the way I handle it, and I've been working with my legal team on this, is we make it part of our, when we sign contracts, it's just in the contract. The security exhibit says, I'm going to be able to do this if I want to do this. But where you need to fight for that is with the vendors who are a little bit more, where you really need to make sure it shows up in the contract is for your massive PHI vendors, your offshore vendors. You don't have to do this for every single vendor. Sometimes they're less risky. If, for example, but if let's just say you never put it in the contract and you're not in a position to put it in the contract, you leverage the relationship. Do you want to keep doing business with me? Yes or no? If it's yes, then they'll let you do this. But again, I encourage you to only do the heavy-hitting on-site assessments for your truly high-risk vendors. You don't want to, it's really expensive to do these on-site assessments. You want to pick and choose your moments. But yes, good question, great question. Okay. Forms, we just talked a little bit about forms. This is a way just to track it internally. Again, there's a lot of approaches to this. You can use some of the industry standard templates for this if you want to, like SIG, SIGLITE, AUP, HITRUST. You can do that kind of stuff. But you want to make sure the biggest issue here is if you do flag something, you want to track the remediation effort to closure. Again, companies will gladly manage this for you, even if it's just the email exchange back and forth. They don't, even if there's no on-site component, they'll handle this for you. I've gone through many, many hundreds, actually, of these. Certifications and tools. A word about this. For your super low, your low-priority vendors, people who don't have any access to data, don't support a critical function, you could, in this case, do enough due diligence to just check out their certifications or, say, monitor them on something like a BitSight or a risk scorecard or I think there's one called iTrust. You know, there's a bunch of them. And that way, if you're on a shoestring budget, you can just confirm that the certifications are current and you can look them up and make sure. A lot of the firms, offshore firms, will send you fraudulent certification numbers. Hurts me to say that, but that has happened. So you got to look them up, make sure they're legit, make sure they're current. Sometimes they'll be for the last decade, and they just kind of hope you go, okay, cool, great, ISO, super. You can also have them, you get spot check. Pick a couple of reports that you care about, and then have them send you an up-to-date one, and make sure that they didn't just get that certification that moment in time, and then let the program drop. And then again, if you've got a little bit of money to spend, you can use one of these services to monitor your vendor portfolio and see if they've had any incidents, see what their risk cadence is overall. And if you have any questions about anything that's on this slide about, you know, tooling, how much things cost, vendors I use, just email me. I just didn't want to use this as a sales opportunity or promote, because I'm pretty vendor agnostic. But if there's anything you want to know about, I've had some good experiences and some bad experiences, and I'm happy to share it all.
You'd mentioned the offshore sites. We've avoided those per our legal counsel, but could you speak to that a minute? Is it a safe option? Is it not a safe option? It doesn't sound safe, but your take on that.
It's a great question, and I think it comes down a lot to how you implement, how they connect to you. There's a way to do it in a way where they can't really hurt you. If you make it so they can't screen scrape, you make it so they can't print locally, you make it so they're in a safe room, and in that case, you're mitigating the risk a little bit. You got to make sure that I have a certain bent on this. I feel like once you've spent all the money securing offshore vendors, sometimes it really offsets the discount you think you're getting. So you got to really be careful about that piece. But there are ways to implement it in a way that's, you know, safe enough that you aren't completely exposing your data set. But again, you got to think it through.
Even beyond the secure, you know, or can you validate that they're secure? Can you do an on-site? But what are the laws in that country that you're offshoring the data to? They may not have the same governance structure that the United
Absolutely.
States does or your company does.
Absolutely.
So even in a contractual agreement, that may not relate to a criminal prosecution. It may be civil, and even then you're going to have a hard time moving that through. So it depends on what mm-hmm. the legal responsibilities are in that country and the law sets are too. And beyond that, just the cost of securing that data there.
Is it really worth it?
It could go beyond. And it's a risk-based decision that you have to make depending on the process that's going to be involved.
True. And I'm thinking of a vendor that has both options, onshore and offshore. You pay more, obviously, for the onshore. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't know. I'm assuming that they would be regulating that again. It's an assumption.
That's
what I'm thinking. So I think we'll stick with the onshore, but I was just wanted your take on that. So.
That's a great question. So step 5 is all about how do you actually put this into practice once you've gotten the inventory and you've risk rated everybody and decided what bucket they go into. For onboarding and reevaluation, these are sort of the steps here. The contract begins, you gotta identify the business sponsor. Sometimes the business doesn't wanna be involved in this kind of stuff, but they gotta be. They're the only one who knows what the person's doing for us, so you gotta sort of loop them in. Something I will tell you, that when I was running the program at Citi, so much money got saved out of identifying the third parties and deciding if you still need, there were so many redundant vendors that we were using in four different business units and paying varying different rates to, and once we compared notes, we got the lowest rate. I mean, a lot of money got saved. It was a security program, and it just was saving money left, right, and center because it was giving it that second look once over. So there can be some really great gains. So if people are resisting this, you know, this is something to highlight. IT risk review, again, make sure that you put them in the right bucket for what they do for you, and then perform the assessments that we just talked about based on that classification. Legal review, this is super important. You want to make sure that your security, your privacy, and your cyber liability requirements are all in. I recommend coming up with a security section, exhibit, I believe is what the lawyers call it, and feel good about it as a security person, and make sure it ends up in every contract. And if there's changes to that, make sure you agree that those changes are not material. In that way, there's consistency across your program, and you don't have to wonder if you let that vendor do that as an exception or that vendor do that as an exception. And then you also want to make sure that if you engage with a vendor, that it doesn't put you in conflict with what you've said to your clients you'll do. For example, maybe your client said, don't offshore. Well, you don't want to then offshore. You know, you got to make sure that whatever you've signed with these vendors isn't in conflict with your, you know, upstream commitments. A financial review, again, this is another opportunity to reevaluate the services that are being provided and make sure you're getting the right value. You got to manage all the artifacts. Again, you can do it manually through SharePoint sites, databases, or you can get something like a GRC tool. And then that's where the sort of contract process ends. For monitoring, because so basically when you set up the contract, that's a moment in time, but then you got to make sure that as things happen to these vendors that you're not now becoming at risk. So you want to make sure that they're following up with their SLAs, both from an operational point of view as well as from a security point of view. You can, again, monitor them through a BIT site or a risk scorecard where you can see up-to-date things happening for that vendor. You also, if you have a GL, if there is, for example, one we just had experienced, WannaCry, you kind of want to make sure you have a distribution list for your vendors so you can email all of them and say, hey, are you patched for WannaCry, yes or no? GRC tools do this automatically for you, but you could also do it yourself just to make sure your downstream risk has been mitigated. Again, ongoing assessments based on the criteria we discussed before. Use your IT team to manage the connections. Make sure that you're using the most secure connections between yourself and the vendor and make sure that they are in sync. And make sure that, you know, the business need, do we still need this vendor? Do we still need to be sending them data? Are we sending them enough volume to even warrant having, you know, maybe three vendors that do the same thing? Why can't we make it two? And just sort of every decision like that, you mitigate the risk. Disengagement, this is huge, and people always forget this piece. Always, always, always. They just stop paying them and move on. You can't do that. You gotta ask them to send back the data. If you've agreed with them that you should in your contract say that they will destroy your proof that they destroyed the data that they had on site, make sure you get that attestation from them. If you're rolling in cash, you don't know what to do with it, do an on-site assessment, make sure they really did get rid of it, although that's usually prohibitively expensive, but you can try. Make sure that you pull all network connectivity to them. Make sure everything gets yanked. Remove all their accounts. People over time, especially vendors you've done business with a long time, have a way of sort of creeping into your infrastructure. Make sure that they completely have no more access anymore. This is a very common source of breaches right here. Vendors that are no longer doing business with you, causing you harm. And update all of your tools. Just make sure that any tool that you were using to manage this, the GRC tool, any inventory tools, any spreadsheets, make sure that they've been properly reclassified as a decommed vendor. Okay, and so if you follow that five-step plan, I assure you will be able to lock down your third-party risk. Now, I understand programs like this, it's complicated at first because a lot of people haven't been doing it all along, and so there's an initial pain when you start it, getting that inventory and then getting everyone to get on board and sort of weigh in and start doing the right thing as you bring in these new vendors. But if you follow that approach, you will mitigate the risk significantly. And again, I'll make sure this is available. And I just wanted to check time here a little bit. Okay, so now I want to talk about getting money. So this is actually based on after, because this morning Mac kept saying, do this, do this, do this, do this. And everything he was telling you to do was all good ideas, but he didn't say how to do it, and he didn't say how to get money to do it. That's what I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today. It involves a little fear-mongering, I'll be honest. But this is the stakeholder map. These are all the people that are going to buy into your program and be inputs for you getting budget or not. You've got the C-suite, of course. You've got your peers who are vying for the same amount of money. You've got your support team and your blue team that are involved supporting you, employees, third parties, privileged users in this case. And I want to talk about privileged users is anybody who has accelerated access. If you right now are on your laptops and you can install software on there, you're a privileged user. It means you have local admin rights to your account. And yes, you shaking your head, and I'm going to get it removed. So you should go back and just say, I don't want local admin rights anymore to my laptop. I do not actually want to bring the company down. As you say to your IT team, I assure you they'll take away your local admin rights. And of course, the board. So this is my plan. It's a 365-day plan for getting every single one of those stakeholders engaged and on board with what you're trying to pull off. And for the ones that have the purse, hold the purse strings, you'll see how they become convinced. So let's start in January. Now I do something, and this is super controversial that I do this. I'm hoping you like the idea. Some of you may have heard of it before. I do this whenever I take over a team. And it doesn't have to be a security team or a risk team, any type of team. It's what I do first. And I have something I call White Hat Summit. If you've got a better name than I have, call it whatever you want. I go to the management team and I say to them, I want the name of anyone in the company who, if they had a bad day, could take it down. And I want that name, I want that list across IT, I want it across the business. And at first everyone bristles and says, oh no, I don't know anyone who matches that description. I'm like, I know you do, I'm gonna sit and wait, you're gonna give me the names. And then slowly but surely the names come out, and then what I do is I fly them to me. And I sit in a room and I say to them, if you had a bad day, how could you hurt the company? And again, I do this regardless of what I'm doing. Whatever team I'm taking over, if I'm new to a company, if I'm new to whatever, you do this. And I can tell you that you don't even get a chance to introduce yourself. People can't wait to tell you. And the reason they can't wait to tell you is because a lot of the times they haven't been listened to, or it's not been a priority, or they're very excited to show you how clever they are. So a couple of best practices around this. So you want to separate technology and the business for obvious reasons, but technology is not usually in the habit of airing their dirty laundry in front of the business, and the business has a bunch of issues that really are not something technology is particularly focused on. Whatever comes out of this meeting is so useful and so important, you have to keep it safe. So when you now have this list of things that can break down the company, everyone's going to want access to it. You can't give it to them. It's critical that what you do with this information is that you layer it into your roadmap, however you need to use it. If you're a CIO, layer it in there. If you're a CISO, layer it into your particular roadmap. If you're a risk manager, do the same. Whatever the case is, but make sure the data is anonymized. This is the very beginning of a special relationship with a really cool group of people that are going to support you as you try to make your organization more safe and more sound. And the worst way you can do that is by saying, guess who told me this? That's not going to help you at all. So you got to establish that trust and create this environment of sharing so that you can then turn whatever gets shared with you into a to-do list. And it also helps you get a lay of the land. So something when you're running this, make sure you limit senior presence. Maybe you are that super intimidating person that people don't want to share with, then delegate this task to someone who's perhaps less intimidating. And you can sort of get feedback that way. If people start talking to you about stuff that's not security or risk related or whatever you're focused on, don't stop them from talking. Let them keep talking. It's important what bothers people, because sometimes it has a knock-on effect in your area. And also, it's critical to an understanding the kind of pressures, where money's being spent, what kind of challenges there are from a technology point of view. Super pro tip, no judgment. There's going to be things that get said in meetings like this where you're going to go, what? We do what? That's what you've been doing? For how long? Who did you tell? You can't have any of these reactions. You've got to be very neutral. And it's not about blaming. It's just about fixing the issue. So, and again, this is a great way to get funding for your program, because when you get this list and you anonymize it and you turn it into a to-do list, it's not a bunch of theoretical stuff, best practices in the industry, stuff you brought from your previous job. It's stuff specific to that company that is going to resonate with the people who are deciding how money gets spent. This is a very powerful exercise if you can pull it off. And again, you got to be self-aware enough to know if you can lead this or if you should delegate this. So, has anyone ever done something like this? Okay, well, if you decide to do it, let me know how it goes. It tends to have very good results. So, for budget, again, you can do it. You can do a WebEx if you want. But it's best to bring everyone there in person and have them do it on site. And this it facilitates sharing. And a lot of the times, the people in this room. Don't get along with each other in the past or haven't been in the same room together before, and it's really great to get them in the same room and build that. We're good to check. Okay, just keep me up to date. Okay, so that's the White Hat Summit. Phishing exercises. Everybody knows about phishing exercises, but they're so poorly done. A couple of best practices around phishing exercises I want to talk to you about. And again, I recommend doing this quarterly for metrics and sort of keep everyone on their toes. So a majority of breaches occur when people click on links, and they bring malware into the company and it takes over things. So really creating awareness around this is key. It's amazing what people will click on. I haven't had a clean phishing exercise run yet. And this third bullet here is my favorite. It's why everyone in this room is going to have a job. But it's also very sad, which is that 30% of Americans will click on malicious links knowing they're malicious because they want to see what happens. This is for real. And this is one of those things that's really hard to defend against. This brand of curiosity, let's call it. And ransomware and malware attacks are up 1,800% since last year, and I actually think that number is very conservative. I think it's a lot more than that. And why? Because they're so easy to run. As an attacker, they take but moments to launch. Very hard to trace back to an individual, or even if they're easy, it's not usually worth the money to do it. And you can hit a lot of people at one time, and someone's gullible enough to click on it almost every time. So very little risk, a lot of reward. Let's skip past that. So round one, when you roll one out, especially at a new organization or if you're trying to hit refresh on your program, I recommend bringing in a couple of key leads, help them understand what you're doing, build that awareness about what's happening. Round two, nobody's safe, make sure everyone gets one. And then for round three, when the people fall for it, make sure they go to a link where there's some training to help them do better. Round four, and I put the word enforcement, which is tougher than I mean for it to be. If round four people are still falling for it, pull them aside and say to them, why didn't this work for you? What about this email made you click on it again? And just try to have that conversation and raise the awareness that way. A couple of things about multiple templates. Whenever you roll these out, and some of you might be used to this, some of this might be new. Make sure there's multiple templates, because there's always people in the company who will get on board and say, we're being attacked, everybody, delete this email. And then your phishing exercise is dead. So you got to have at least three different templates to make sure they stay live enough to go out and complete the exercise. Make sure there's urgency behind it. If it's a voluntary email, like, do this if you want to check this out, it won't work. Make sure there's urgency. And if you have the multiple templates, try to make sure they go to certain parts of your company, For example, one of them was, oh, your last paycheck was short $200-something, click here to get it back. And my COO wrote me and said, LMAO, LOL, next time make it for more money. So you kind of got to make sure that you're sending the right bait to the right people. Make sure it's anybody who has access, your vendors, your contractors, your consultants, anybody. Anyone who's got access to your system, if they got an AD account, they get one. And you want to publish the metrics on the organizational level. It creates that sort of competition between the orgs, but also helps them, also helps you understand different challenges. So sales and marketing has to click on tons of stuff they may not want to, because they're in the business of dealing with clients and dealing with opportunities. Whereas IT is usually pretty good at going, I don't know why you'd send me that. I don't know why you'd send me that. So it doesn't mean that IT is better than sales and marketing. It just means that, you know, there's a different likelihood of needing to click on something from an unknown source. If you're doing this by yourself and building these, do not store the phished credentials. I can't tell you how many times people do this, where they harvest credentials, someone will type in, oh, this is my login and password, and they're like, oh, look, someone took the bait, and now we got their login and password. Okay, now you just created a database with everyone's logins and passwords in it. Don't do that. Just flag that someone entered the data. Don't store it, or you've now just created a whole nother system you got to protect. My pro tip here, when you launch a phishing campaign, people open service tickets. Your service desk is spent enough as it is with real problems. The last thing you want to do is layer on hundreds of fake incidents on them. So if you do that, which I do 4 times a year, I get them Dunkin' Donuts. They love Dunkin' Donuts. So I send them to them so that they can, you know, maybe forgive me, maybe just a little bit for having them open hundreds of bogus tickets. So, you know, just something you might want to find out from your service desk what they like and maybe treat them to something. Again, phishing exercises, very inexpensive. You can have a talented scripter write them themselves. You can buy a tool. Again, there's not much money in this. The benefit of buying the tool is it tracks particular users over a period of time and auto-generates the metrics for you. Now we're going to talk about ethical hackers. So I promised that I would, and this is what we're talking about. I love leveraging ethical hackers to get budget, because it really highlights in a meaningful way to your teams what's really going on here. So penetration testing, think about, these are people, what they're trying to get through, and I know this gets a little technical, so we can talk about it offline if I go too techie here, but pen testing is sort of a large surface area. Think if you have a circle, think about it as testing the edge of the circle. If you get through door number one, they write up the finding. So it's just about testing your perimeter. This is testing for script kiddies. This is testing for people who are just launching attacks here, there, everywhere, not someone who's specifically targeting you. But this is a great way to show and fix some of the more obvious things that are externally facing to the outside world. Vulnerability assessments, this is a deep dive into your code. This is not to be confused with vulnerability scanning, a very different thing. This is actually making sure your entire code set is free of vulnerabilities. And this is really important, and this takes a very specific skill set because it needs to be someone who's not just really amazing at coding, but really good at, so good at coding that they're able to find vulnerabilities in the code itself. So this is a very particular skill set. And the red team is really the one that has the report that usually scares everyone the most. If you've ever heard of or played the game Capture the Flag, that's a little bit what red team is like, where you say, I want you to get to my database, or I want you to get to my domain controllers, or I want you to get to whatever is important to you and your company. You say, I want you to get to that. And then they spend however long it takes getting to those items. So it means going through door number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to get to it. And this is the best representation of if you're being targeted. And for everyone in this room, if you have PHI, I assure you, you're being targeted. And this is going to be interesting to you because this helps you know how you would withstand an ongoing, consistent attack from someone who's desperately trying to get in. So this isn't the amateurs. This is for the people who are coming after you specifically. And the findings from this are always extremely, really very interesting and can be leveraged, especially to get your IT teams and your management teams and the executive team engaged in understanding what you're facing. And of course, I picked these three people because they don't want to be bad guys, but they have to be, you know, in order to fight the bad guys, they got to be even better than them. So, some of my faves. Couple of tips here. Make sure it's off hours for whenever your clients work with you. Again, like we were talking about before, these will break systems, and you do not want to take down your systems when clients are relying on them. If you don't have much money, focus on your externally facing stuff, maybe things that have PHI in them as a priority. You should do everything externally facing, but if you must, choose the PHI only or externally facing. Make sure all of your systems are setting off bells and whistles. If you have protections in place, as these ethical hackers are doing their thing, make sure alarm bells are going off. Make sure your team is reacting. Make sure things are happening and you're reacting accordingly. If they come back to you and they say, oh, we owned you, and you have nothing go off in your security operations center or in your SIM or anything, you're blowing it. You gotta find out what happened and why you didn't know about it. You gotta prioritize the findings. Sometimes there'll be a high to some person, a critical to another, and a medium to another. Something I always like to advise is, it is in the ethical hacker, whoever they are, they are gonna take a conservative approach to the risk rating. Things are gonna come back as critical that maybe you don't agree are critical. It's really important to have that dialogue and say, okay, I know why you think this is a high, but I think it's not a high because I have these 10 controls in place you maybe don't know about. So the report you get back is an opening bit. It's the beginning of a conversation of back and forth. What can we do to actually mitigate this and get rid of the real risk that we're facing. Also, scanners versus humans. I deal with this a lot, especially on the IT side of the house, where you'll get varying different reports. And the team will say, well, I didn't touch the code at all. Why do you have a finding now that you didn't find the last time? It's because humans are doing the hacking, and that's what you want. Scanners are great for your day-to-day, but what you want is that human skill set coming up with new and interesting ways to get in. And sometimes that's not always consistent, and that doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it may be a different style or a different script. So, you have to face that a lot when you bring this into the equation. Careful messaging with findings. When I used to manage a bunch of applications, I did a situation where I actually did vulnerability assessments before. I trained the developers in how to do defensive coding. I pretty much said to them, hey, I'm gonna give you a test. I'm not gonna tell you what's on the test. You can't study for the test, and then you're gonna get a score at the end. And it was pretty, it's really not very nice for the developers to experience it in that order. So when you get these findings, be gentle. This is not an opportunity to embarrass everyone. This is an opportunity to get the place more safe. All right. So again, there's a bunch of open source tools you can use, like Burp. I didn't name it. Internal security champions. If you've got some skilled people in your teams, they can help you do this. There's scanning and subscription tools. These are lesser. This is where I would spend some cash, because when you spend a little bit of money, you get a lot back from your company, because they see that if they were to fix these things, that they would be able to avoid these bad things from happening to the company. Services and consulting. Again, I highly recommend spending some bucks around this area, because you're going to get so much value out of it. Different vendors for every exercise type. Vulnerability assessment people refuse to do pen testing. Red team people sometimes refuse to do pen testing, and the reverse. So you sometimes need different vendors to do all three types. And also, if you've got the money, I recommend using different vendors to do the same exercise type. I vary who does my pen tests all the time. I want to see what different people come back with using different styles. So how many people have done a tabletop exercise? So you've done one? Anybody else? Yes, okay. All right. I'll talk a little bit about it. I can't believe it's that few people. I was thinking everyone was going to raise their hand and I was going to skip this, but it's not going to happen. So a tabletop exercise is the really PC way of saying what we used to call war games back in the day. We did it usually for disaster recovery and business continuity. And now what we do is we get in a room and we simulate a lot of really bad stuff happening over a three-hour period. And that three-hour period represents maybe days, weeks, months in the life of a breach. So you simulate a breach happening. It involves your executive team and all of your support vendors. So again, it's usually a three-hour exercise where you go through and things keep happening, they get worse and worse and worse and worse, and you talk about how you react. So you need to have complete executive participation. This is not a moment for your CFO to go, oh, this is your weird, dorky cyber stuff, I'm out. They need to be there. It's really important for all the reasons we talked about before, which is cyber insurance, all this other kind of stuff. You need to have the entire executive team there. You need to make sure if you have an incident response plan, you've socialized it. If you don't have a breach response plan, go make one now. It's not the time when you actually have a breach to start drafting that up. Make sure, injects is the word we use to describe giving people certain tasks. During the exercise, you want to sort of single certain people out and see how they react in an emergency crisis. You want to have one for everyone in the room so they have a chance to speak or a chance to react, a chance to feel like they're part of it. A great one is to give your CEO one that says, blah, blah, blah from the board is calling, they want to know what happened. Or sales and marketing saying, your client heard about it on the news, how are you reacting? So this kind of stuff to make sure everyone understands that if there is a breach, it's all hands on deck. No one is spared. This is not an IT problem. This is a company-wide problem. Usually after I do the main one, sometimes people want to do a focused session. It's 3 hours, which sounds like a long time, but it's really not. And you go through so many things that happen that certain people will leave it going, oh, well, I had so many questions about how I would have reacted this way. So you can do focused sessions with the different areas of your company if you've got the cycles and the interest. The result of these is usually about 20 to 25 observations, things that went well, things that didn't go well. I've been in situations where it has been a meltdown and no one wants to take responsibility, and I've been in situations where people have been very, know what their role is. So everyone's got their strengths, every organization. Pro tip, seriously. So what you'll have in the room is you'll have your outside counsel, you'll have your forensics team, you'll have your PR firm. So they will be in the room supporting you. Sometimes these vendors like to really use this as an opportunity to showcase their skills, maybe the services that they can offer you. And sometimes you really wish you could put them on mute, and it's hard when they're in the room. So what I would recommend is if you have a tabletop exercise and you have a vendor who just likes to talk maybe a bit too much and take over the floor, next time you have it, have them join by phone. Saying general counsel. Usually the legal teams really like to, the external, your strong counsel has a way of sometimes taking over. So I recommend having them join by phone. Usually the forensics and the PR vendors tend to sort of be shadows as opposed to the focus, depending on how this scenario is going. Yes.
Can you give a real life example of one of the sessions? One of the tabletop exercise you did, or
sure.
Somebody else also?
So I can tell you, usually I love showcasing that, obviously given my background, that third parties can take you down. So usually it starts off with, there's been a breach, there's been a breach, your data's been posted, and they're saying that you've been hacked. And then it usually escalates, and then you realize it's perhaps it's an hacktivist who's angry with the healthcare system and thinks that the Republicans could be doing way better by people, and so they're going after healthcare companies and they're posting data from a bunch of places. You find out it all came from this one third party, and then it makes the news. How do you handle that? So you just kind of show the escalation of what's happening. You usually want to have a little bit of an air of mystery of who the attacker is. That way you are thinking, is it an insider threat? I love having an insider component as well. I love having people share too much on social media from your own company to show how people have a way of just getting a little too oversharing and how that can hurt you too. So insider, third party, you know, accidental venting, and then what you really want to end with is massive media attention. How do you handle that? Do you have a call center? Something else to focus on is, especially with when I was at the bank, we had a bunch of massive breaches happen where there was a run on support vendors. So, you know, there are only so many people who do forensics, only so many people who do call centers. You want to talk about what are you doing if you're doing it yourself because your vendor has not prioritized you. Side note, when you set up contracts with these vendors, make sure there's a clause in there where you will get top billing should there be a run on security on support vendors in a breach. It's really important.
There's a second question. There's another thing which I struggle with, the incident response plan. So we hired a consultant. She did a good job. But I look at it, it's more fluff, which is good for me to share it with an auditor and all, but it does not really list out, okay, if I have a phishing attack going on, if I have a ransomware attack going on, what are the things we should be doing? So I wanted to hear some perspective on that.
Right, and I think that, you know, that's sort of a classic thing with incident response, that these plans are really bloated and maybe not as useful as you might like them to be. I think the idea is what you want to have in place is you want to have, how do we communicate with each other if we lose? How do we communicate with each other under good circumstances, have bridge information, email addresses, distro lists, and how do we communicate with each other if everything goes down? I think those are the most key components to make sure that's in place. Everyone can talk to each other in a way that's secure and meaningful. If you have that in your incident response plan, you're half the way there. The rest I would put in appendix, like have an appendix for each of those different particular attack types, and then maybe turn to it just to give you some guidance on how to react. But I agree with you that I've been a part of many, many incident response efforts and an occasional breach and at the bank, and basically it sort of gets thrown out, right? It's more about just creating that mindset of scenario planning and sort of laying out how can we react to this if this were to happen. The chances of you flipping through that 300-page document in a real crisis, pretty low. It's more about sort of helping people understand that it exists. And again, making sure people can stay in communication even when you lose your internal means of doing so is huge, for sure. Okay, I'll sort of blow through these. Okay, I recommend spending money on this. They're not that expensive to get done, and you don't want to be the person, especially if you're me, telling the CEO, the COO, or the CFO that you thought they could have done better. You know, you don't want that message to come from you. You want it to come from somebody else from outside the company who can sort of mediate that piece of the puzzle. If you don't have the money to spend on this, you can have someone in your, I assure you there's someone who works for you or works near you who's super into Mr. Robot and has thought about a million really cool scenarios on how to, you know, monkey with companies that can help you write this, and you could run it if you must. So there's ways to do this, and again, super effective. When you show the executive team how quickly things can escalate, they get more on board for creating protections and creating awareness. So, all right. Roundtables, I'll go very quickly with this. I recommend, if company probably does a bunch of roundtables with the different teams, go on site and at least twice a year, and make sure that when you're asking people to do stuff to protect the company, don't put it in terms of protecting the company, put it in terms of them protecting themselves. There's nothing I'm gonna ask you to do for Multiplan that I wouldn't ask you to do, you know, with your family, and you're gonna talk about that in a little bit, so I'm not gonna talk about that, but it's like there's nothing I'm gonna ask you to do that's just for work. So don't talk about it just for work. Talk about it in terms of them keeping themselves safe as an individual, and it really resonates with people. People love talking about cyber. Stick around after the round table and let people tell you their horror story, let people tell you what they read about in the news or they saw on TV and thought was interesting. I can't tell you how many people come to me who have nothing to do with IT, nothing to do with InfoSec or risk, who have some really unique insight about something they see happening that bothers them in some way. And it's only because I've gone to these roundtables and I've created that vibe that they feel comfortable coming to me and saying something about it. So everybody, it's all hands on deck.
I was just going to follow up with what you said about the personal touch. Is I had a quick conversation with Mac afterwards, and you know, he said he's even seen organizations go so far as to fish not just their employees, but their family members as well.
Absolutely.
Not in a mean sort of way, but a learning, education, fun sort of way. And it is a nice next step to follow up with that personal touch.
I agree. It's really about raising awareness. It's just important. It's just important you protect yourself at home, for sure. All right, wrapping up here. Social engineering exercise, the last thing I want to talk about. I hire a firm every year to do a 30-day exercise during Cyber Risk Assessment Month to go to the next level of calling people, doing tailgating, physical attack, you know, show up on site, see if they can tailgate, see if they can do man-in-the-middle attacks, email, do spear phishing campaigns. 30 days, when you have your company for 30 days experiencing this kind of exercise, it really raises the awareness. People get really on, you know, it doesn't create stress, it creates like a fun vibe because they know it's what we're doing. Everybody, no one should be spared this exercise, regardless of the level. Sometimes people have this sort of focus around protecting your VIPs. Your VIPs are some of the most exposed. You know, that's not really, you know, make sure everyone's involved. I do recommend having a few key executive team people on your side that you can use their name. So the most recent time I did this, I actually didn't give the executive team a heads up, and I had the social engineers using their names left, right, and center saying, you know, Michael said that you need to change your password, and he's getting phone calls going, why is people saying that? I said that they should give their password up. So you gotta pick a few allies in this process so that, you know, you can go totally off the rails here. If you've never seen social engineering happen, there's some, again, I just was recently at Black Hat DEF CON. DEF CON has something called Social Engineering Village, where they just sit in booths and just see what they can get from companies. They get conference rooms, badges sent to them, new laptops, things catered, unbelievable things. And I think they've a couple on YouTube if you want to see how that works. It's actually kind of fun to watch. And again, Americans are extra vulnerable. We want to be helpful. We want to know the answer. We want to be experts. And the social engineers count on that and love that. They love that you're so quick to overshare. So that's the social engineering exercise. And I assure you that if you roll out all these different programs, and again, you can have some savvy people in your team help you do this, or you can outsource this as well. And at the end of this, all your stakeholders will have been involved in your exercises. And I assure you that if you had budget trouble before, I think that you will have quite a bit more spend in the year that comes after. Any questions? And that's to get to my team. And you know, if you have any questions or want to see a slide in particular or anything, I'm happy to share. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Questions? Oh, clapping. Clapping first. Questions. We got the clapping.
I think
we got
people
a lot
need
of
to
questions
thaw
throughout.
Out. It's cold in here.
We can't get it right.
So we incorporate that, our tabletop testing, and we do 4 hours. It's a half a day. I cater cookies and cokes and bribes to get them there. And it's our directors and their seconds in charge. And literally, and we incorporate this along with our disaster recovery. The buildings just burned down. There were certain cards. If you picked a card, that meant you died. And, you know, just right off it, the first year we did it, it's probably 5-6 years ago, the first year we did it, our CEO got the death card, you know, and it was just playing cards, and he got the jack, and that means you're dead, you know, that kind of thing. The whole exercise stopped right there at the CEO because he had the call tree. You know, it's things like that you don't know about it until you're missing a key factor to whether it's a breach or whether it's a true disaster recovery exercise. But every year, somebody else is, and it's purely by the draw, or who has the chocolate chip cookie, you know, it's that you can't play. Does your second step in, and do they know what to do in your place? And it's a long, drawn-out day. We're all exhausted, but every year, something changes in that plan just because a different nuance came or a different way of a breach or a different virus that did ransomware. Every year it changes, so you just have to do it every year.
Absolutely, and if you're going to spend that much of your executive team's time doing something like this, and their time is very valuable, you've got to make it relevant. You've got to make it different from last year, or people will just snooze.
And it's completely off-site. We don't have it where somebody can come to a conference room and knock, I need you a minute. We go completely off-site and leave our departments open for it. But it's a four-hour draining day. And then we come out with a document, I make modifications, and then our CEO signs it. I distribute it to everybody so they have that packet. This year I put it up on a web place where they can go get it with a password. So that was another thing. If we have a disaster, our disaster plan is on a server that just got burned down or just got hacked and I had to take it offline. We can't get to it. Oh, let's put it up on the internet. So just different things.
Different things. A lot of stuff gets surfaced. Absolutely.
So just one comment and a question. The comment, awesome Pokemon ball up there, by the way.
But I was hoping someone would know
The question is, that white hat exercise you were talking about early on that happens early in the year,
yes.
You had mentioned that you reach out to people that have had a bad day or something along those lines. Can you give me like a brief, like I'd like to learn about what that process involves and how that works.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, in an organization, you'll find that, for example, you know, there's people that that show up to you as being a little more savvy in the cyberspace than others. And, you know, people who have lots of admin rights, who are just super techie or have a certain mindset. Usually gamers are great for this kind of stuff. People who have been with the company for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and kind of know where all the bodies are buried. These kinds of people, and again, these aren't malicious people. These are people who have the mindset of they know how things could be broken. They know what has been skipped in past implementations. They have a tremendous amount of rights, a lot of admin rights. These are the kinds of people you get in the room, like your Unix administrators, your Windows admins. Like, these are the people that you want to come and talk to you on the tech side. On the business side, it's really just the people who know the client super well, who know the applications extremely well, and it can help you fill in the side of, what do these applications do, which ones are more important, less important, and that helps you put a risk framework around that. And you might be surprised. Some of the business people actually have some pretty clever ideas on how they're usually pretty savvy when it comes to what would be hurtful and not hurtful to the company. And then the IT side helps you understand the control side of the house and if it's possible or not. But yes, absolutely. We can talk more about that. It's my favorite exercise. It's really fantastic.
I was just trying to incorporate that into... So we do a business resumption review for different departments. And I like that concept of taking that outside of a formal process and more of a conversation and spending some time at the beginning of the year just to pick some people out and talk about, it is a risk assessment, but it's a risk assessment on the sly type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like that concept of building those relationships, understanding the foundation, not having a spaz when they relate certain things, but I think it'd be a powerful tool in the tool belt to add to any information security program.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. It's fun and it's super informative.